All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. Our next guest today is Andrew Rice from the September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. His brother, David Rice, worked at the firm Sandler O'Neill & Partners in the South Tower and died on September 11th. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks.
Briefly, tell us a little bit about your brother and about yourself.
Yeah, my brother, David, worked for Sandler O'Neill, and he was living in Chicago for quite a while, and got the chance to be transferred to New York, where I was living at the time, and my younger sister was living there. So we'd all grown up in Oklahoma City, but had made our way to New York through various, you know, routes. And so we were excited that we got a chance to be around each other again since we were little. And but it ended up being tragic, of course, too, because, you know, David would never have been there that morning if he had never been transferred. He was just one of these guys who was just sort of, you know, we actually had a hard time at his funeral cutting down the number of people for his to be pallbearers. We actually had his body, which is sort of a rarity with September 11th, and because he had so many people he was close to, he had a lot of people that they considered him his best friend, because he was sort of one of those people who was always there for you. You know, if you had a crisis in your life, he'd come to your house in the middle of the night. So he's sorely missed, not just by myself and my family, but by a lot of friends as well. But of course, you know, he was one of thousands of people killed that day.
So when the organization September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows started coming together, what made you decide to get involved, or when, I guess?
Yeah, it was started in February of 2002, around Valentine's Day. I was not involved at that point. I got involved about 2 months later. When it was started, symbolically, they decided to send President Bush a Valentine's card, sort of, you know, lighthearted, to talk about the, at that time, the main issue when it first started was the loss of civilian lives in Afghanistan through errant U.S. bombs, and just sort of raising awareness about that, drawing parallels between the loss of civilian lives and deaths from terrorism, just hoping that we could find a way to apprehend those responsible for September 11th without causing more tragedies. That was sort of the initial imperative. I got involved, one, because of that reason. I mean, you know, I know idealistically if you're going into war, that there's going to be violence and death, both of combatants and non-combatants. But it troubled me that civilians in Afghanistan that didn't have anything to do with Al-Qaeda would be caught up in the middle of this. But secondly, and probably more importantly, I knew that sort of looking at the roots of terrorism and looking at the political conflict that brought about September 11th, conventional war wasn't even going to work anyway, as far as solely as a way of preventing another terrorist attack and really solving the problem. There's going to have to be sort of a critical look at our foreign policy and trying to figure out how we could go about our business in the world in a way to where, you know, our image was better and we could be more consistent with our own standards of human rights and things like this. So it took me a while. I mean, this was April 2002, and I was concerned about this stuff in the fall, but just dealing with the shock and the grief of losing my brother. So was really relieved to see that there was an organization like Peaceful Tomorrows there when I was ready for it. I actually found it on the internet through some progressive groups.
Well, when you talk about, you know, getting the people who did it without the excess civilian casualties that come with it, what do you suggest besides conventional warfare that you suggested doesn't work anyway?
Yeah, you know, I know that even with the procedure or the methods that we are more happy with as a group, which is sort of using like a lot of international cooperation through police work to apprehend the terrorists, but there's going to be violence involved in that. I mean, some of the more successful things that the administration has done, like the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Pakistan, who's considered the number three guy in Al-Qaeda and the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. A lot of intelligence work was done to try to figure out where he was. Now, granted, him being in Pakistan was a lot easier in some ways than him being in Afghanistan, because Pakistan is somewhat of an ally, even though they've got a lot of their own problems that we have to deal with fundamentalism in their own government. But, you know, he was apprehended in the middle of the night with very little violence. I know it can't always go ideally like that, but we knew that with this sort of full-out war, especially when you had the Taliban being willing to give up bin Laden to another Muslim country, this is something that a lot of the mainstream press never talks about, which is that they were willing to, if the proof was put forward, or there was a lot of, you know, which there was a lot of intelligence that they were behind it, that they would hand him over to a Muslim country for trial. But that we knew that there was sort of this push to, for all-out war, which we knew there was some more, I'm not going to say sinister, but more U.S.-interested, power-centered, economic-centered reasons for going in all-out war and getting the Taliban out of there, which was sort of killing two birds with one stone. Well, we can go after these guys who just committed this awful crime against us, which everyone in our group wants them apprehended, but we can also have a shift of balance in that area of the world, which is very strategic to us as a country and as a world power. And that was really dirty and left a bad taste in our mouth, that 9/11 was going to be sort of also used as an opportunity to really exert U.S. power. And then, of course, about whatever, a year later, a year and a half later, with the whole Iraq stuff, it became much more obvious that this sort of strategy was going to, this Bush doctrine was going to be pushed forward on the backs of all of those people that were killed on September 11th.
So you guys really would prefer to emphasize police work rather than military force to do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of people in our group specifically talk about, you know, we look at September 11th as a crime against humanity. If you look at my brother's death certificate from the city of New York, it said homicide on it. The idea that it was sort of this act of war, and now we're this sort of ethic war between good and evil, is very scary talk from our president, which makes it even more of a religious terms. And I thought, what would hope, that we'd go in the other way, that we wouldn't sort of get into this sort of battle of good and evil and become fundamentalist in our own way, sort of having God on our side as we fight back. It would be more about, let's look at this, let's look at the, you know, 15 of the 19 were Saudis, and let's look at the double standards that we have supporting the Saudi regime. I mean, you know, you're down in Texas, I'm in Oklahoma, and, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people that I meet on a day-to-day basis who have no idea that Saudi Arabia is not a democracy. They have no idea that our the biggest ally, the biggest Muslim ally that we have in the Arab world, is not a democracy. They just assume that they are because they feel like, well, how could we be close to a government that's not a democracy? They hear all this stuff about Fidel Castro and you know, China. They just assume, and people have no idea the double standards that we put in place when we're dealing with economic reasons in that region and power region. So the resentment that breeds, I'm not saying it warrants or justifies any terrorist attack, I'd never argue that, but looking at what breeds this anti-Americanism, it fuels this stuff, it makes it easier for groups like Al-Qaeda to recruit young people. We knew that one, warfare would inflame that, and that this administration really wouldn't want to look into it, because it would mean really having to fundamentally change sort of the way we went about our relations with these countries. You know, there were no, up until, maybe now it's changed, but up until now, there were no Iraqi or Afghan members of Al-Qaeda. Most of the members of Al-Qaeda come from countries of our allies. Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, Yemen, Indonesia. These are countries that are secular countries. Not one of them is a country of freedom with human rights that are respected. And they all know that the United States government has helped these regimes stay in power for sort of a tit for tat. You help us, we help you. Does that justify terrorism? No. But looking at it as a political lens, looking at it and understanding that sense, you can understand, well, all our conventional wars never, I mean, hasn't worked in Israel with Israel-Palestine, hasn't worked in, you know, we encouraged the British government to negotiate with the IRA and their conflict. And if you even go anywhere near sort of talking about engaging fundamentalists in some sort of, you know, looking at the political sides of their grievances, you're called, you know, sympathizer of evildoers and all this sort of stuff. So, I mean, there's a lot of progress to be made in this country of getting everyday Americans to start talking about the messy political stuff that brings about tragedies like this. And yes, the people who commit them need to be brought to justice, and they need to be punished within the sort of confines of the law. But when you look at what this administration's been about, what they wanted to do when they came into office before 9/11, what they talked about in the private life, in projects like the Project for the New American Century, where they really wanted to be able to take advantage of the Soviet Union being weakened and the United States being really a sole superpower, and they knew that it would take a Pearl Harbor-like event. They wrote about it in a report in 2000. It would take a Pearl Harbor-type event to get the American people to go along with the sort of new military doctrine, and they jumped on it. So that is the sort of stuff that really upsets us, because we feel it's unjust and wrong. It's taking America down a very dangerous path. a lot of it's antithetical to our Constitution, and it's being done out of the murders of our loved ones. We know that there are also, family members of 9/11 victims who probably support the Bush administration's policies, but we're just sort of taking our stance against it.
How many members are there of the Families for a Peaceful Tomorrow?
Now we've got about just over 100 members, which doesn't sound like a lot, but what you have to remember are two really important things. One is that we've never solicited membership. We don't try to get our hands on, address lists of people who lost loved ones on 9/11, send them letters or, go meet them, because we feel it's inappropriate. So all members of Peaceful Tomorrow find out about the group somehow, and we don't get a lot of publicity in the U.S. mainstream press because they don't really want to get anywhere near us, even though a lot of independent alternative media and foreign media cover us. And secondly, speaking out against any Bush administration policy over the last 2 years has been highly unpopular. I mean, you'd think that our group would get a certain amount of leeway, and sometimes we have, but, we've gotten death threats on our website, and we've been screamed at in public and told that we're unpatriotic and all these things, just like all of other Americans who've wanted to dissent over the last 2 years. So those two factors, I think, can contribute to the low numbers, but, I mean, you'd be amazed in the last, especially since, about a year ago when the president went to the UN to say that we needed to go to war with Iraq, until now there's been a lot of new members. Anytime we get a lot of media coverage, we get two or three new members a day. So people are becoming more and more eager about speaking out because we want a balance between justice but also really making sure. I mean, there's all this stuff about after 9/11 about, not letting the terrorists win. Well, don't you let the terrorists win when you start repealing civil liberties, going against very important principles that we have as a country within our Constitution, and start undoing them in response to the terrorist strike. That's letting the terrorists win, I think. So there's a lot of things to be suspicious of and upset about, and I think that more and more people are starting to speak out as the fear of 9/11 starts to diminish a little bit.
Well, so many people died there that day that this has really affected millions of people, not just from watching it on TV, but pretty much everybody knows somebody who knows somebody who died there or something.
Yeah.
And in fact, I mentioned to two gentlemen last night that I was going to interview a guy from Families for Peaceful Tomorrows tomorrow. And they informed me one of them's uncle died there and the other's cousin had died there. And their solution was to kill every Arab on earth. And when I pointed out that, there's a lot of Muslims that aren't Arabs. What about the Persians? Are you going to have to kill all them too? And they said, yes, we need to drop hydrogen bombs on the entire region until they are all dead. Because, they all hate us and they all want to kill us. And the only solution is to bring absolute and total violence to them. Now, I didn't argue the point too much, although, I did argue it, but I didn't, get combative or anything because, my uncle and my cousin didn't die in it. And I don't have those personal feelings about it. Now, I wonder, you sound very reasonable for a guy with a personal loss in this compared to how completely unreasonable these two guys were.
Yeah, well, I think, obviously everybody's got a lot of different stances on it. There are a lot of people who are very angry. I mean, I'm angry my brother was murdered. I wish, I've been watching a little bit of college football today just because it's something that I grew up doing and it's nostalgic, and I wish that my brother was alive that I could do it with him today because it's something we did when we were little. And people are at different points in their journey, to sound a little new agey, but even for sort of personal emotional reasons, people want that sort of response. Okay, whatever. I'm not going to get into sort of the ethics of how wrong that would be. From a pragmatic realism perspective, If our number one priority now as Americans is to be safe, which I think is what most people want, is to be safe, how are we going to go about doing that? You can't really have, some rational conversations with people like that. And I think that that's sort of been one of the things that's become apparent in the last year or so, is we've gotten really involved in trying to stop this war. There are people in our group that are not pacifists. There are people there are some people in our group who even supported the Afghanistan war and different things like that. We realize when we've gone out to talk and speak in the media and different groups that we're sort of talking about, and we're the realists here. To say that occupying an Arab country, which is one of the grievances that bin Laden exploits, that saying, America wants to occupy oil-rich countries in the Middle East, that would actually increase terrorist recruitment. That's not some idealistic, naive argument that anti-war people usually get tagged as, you know. And the Bush Doctrine, which is sort of that we're going to take our form of democracy and our way of doing things and export it around the world with force and intimidation, and that somehow is going to make a region of the world like us more. You tell me who are the idealists and who are the realists. So, you know, and again, we don't claim to speak for 9/11 families, and in a way, I mean, I do think that your opinion or anybody's opinion about September 11th is just as important as anybody who lost someone. I mean, frankly, I'm active because I know I'll get a certain platform that I wouldn't if I didn't lose someone. It's not like I don't care about these things, and you know, but I know that I'll be listened to because my brother was killed, and I care deeply about these things, and so I'm going to take advantage of it. Ideally, in an ideal world, everybody's opinions in a democracy would be weighed equally, and be well respected. But that's sort of how things work, and so our group is trying to sort of take advantage of that and say, hey, you know, we were affected by this tragedy. We want you to hear what we have to say about a solution. And you know, we're starting to do stuff with the Independent Commission. The administration has not been cooperative. It's been very, very uncooperative about releasing information, declassifying things for the Independent Commission to look into stuff. I mean, it's not even that independent of a commission. I mean, these are made up of Washington, D.C. people, former members of the House and Senate. And it's unbelievable. You got Republicans on this commission who are very, very critical of the Bush administration because they're not being cooperative, especially around the stuff on the Saudis. So we're starting to do a big campaign around that, and there's some other 9/11 family groups that are upset about this. So there's a lot of questions that remain unanswered about how could the air defenses have failed us so much that day, you know. How could people who were being investigated for being terrorists allowed just to roam freely in this country and weren't arrested? And you know, there's so much stuff. And this administration has really sort of put a lockdown on it, whether it's because of embarrassment or whatever. They haven't been cooperative. And I think that goes directly against a lot of what they claim to be about, you know. Well, we're fighting for freedom, and it's about American patriotism. And they've done, not everything, but they've done a lot of things that just go into direct contradiction to that. So,
how long is left in that commission? How much time do they have left to get...
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. They have a limited amount of time. At a certain date next year, and I don't know the exact date, but it is in 2004. It's it. They got to have their findings in, and that's it. Which you would think... with something as momentous and huge and life-changing, world-changing as September 11th, that they would allow sort of an unlimited amount of time to look in to correcting the mistakes. There's definitely a lot of suspicious activity on what they're trying to hide. So, you know, I'm not suggesting there's complicity. I'm just saying there is stuff that they don't want people to know about. Saudis have been given preferential treatment with visa applications. And there are relatives of the Bin Ladens. There are Bin Laden relatives who have also had suspicion of being tied in with certain terrorist groups that have connections to Al Qaeda. And members of the Bin Laden family, these specific members who work for a group called WAMY, WAMY, which is like the World Association of Muslim Youth, who lived in D.C., have connections. And a lot of intelligence sources from our allies, countries in Europe, have been after this group. And they were fled part of the Bin Laden family and other studies who were flown out of the country a couple of days after 9/11, while all the flights were banned for the rest of us, and we were sitting around afraid. So, because of how much we've had to look the other way with the Saudis for so many years, because of how much we've needed their oil flow to be stable, and we've looked the other way, it's ended up biting us in some ways. I'm not saying we're responsible for 9/11 attacks, but our double standards have affected us in a really tragic way. And this is something, again, that if you start speaking about in certain quarters in this country, people freak out. You know, there's a certain fragility, I think, among people here that they think, you know, they just can't imagine this stuff, you know. They can't imagine that we've had double standards and we've had our hands in some messy stuff, and they'd just rather think that we're pure victims, like this victimization, you know. And you can be a victim of a crime. You can have an awful thing done to you where the perpetrators need to be brought to justice, but that doesn't mean you don't also have to look at the way we've contributed to the root causes of bringing them about, and the way in which we've been indifferent to problems of injustice in other areas of the world that do feed in to anti-Americanism. Because the anti-Americanism in the Arab world is mostly political. You know, it's not that, oh, they think, you know, there was this whole campaign in Washington to put out these videos in the Arab world, these television commercials showing how great it is to be a Muslim in America. They don't care about whether Muslims in America have freedom to go to the mosque. It's about U.S. policy in their countries. That's what anti-Americanism is about. It's not necessarily, they've used issues like, oh, America being a liberal democracy, or or, you know, women have equal status here, or sort of to rile people up and to get people involved in their groups. But that's not what causes these guys to kill themselves and other people. It's the sense that America is doing things in their countries that are unjust and against Islam. And I'm not saying that their arguments and other grievances are accurate or legitimate, but how do we creatively try to engage that area of the world where we make it harder for them to recruit? We make it harder for someone like bin Laden to argue those arguments to the to these sort of guys who he wants to be involved in the group. You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Well, I want to ask you maybe the hard version of this question.
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
This is all very easy. I mean, if you want, you know, public relations, TV commercials like you're talking about, that's never going to work. And I kind of wonder whether we're deliberately screwing this up, public relations-wise. That maybe we want to have a perpetual crisis in the Middle East so that we have a problem to solve for another 50 or 70 years, because
you're right.
We just went over there and made a good example of, hey, look, y'all, this bin Laden guy's got us all wrong. We're completely benevolent. We're the force of freedom on Earth, and we don't want to hurt nobody. We just want to show you by example about individual liberty. If we acted like that, well, you know, that's some good PR right there, is bringing all our troops home. And I just wonder whether, I mean,
we wouldn't have an enemy.
It's easy to say that George Bush is a doofus and doesn't know what he's doing, but he's got an administration full of
geniuses. Smart. Yeah, they're smart. I mean, there's a lot of credibility to what you're saying. I mean, you know, I can argue both ways on that with you. I mean, yeah, I mean, in the history of this country, there's been a need to have perpetual crises economically, also for our own sense of identity. You know, sort of America is so good because we can make ourselves relevant compared to this awful evil. There's the money-making aspect of, you know, continually having these conflicts to fight in. You know, I mean, there's a columnist for the New York Times who I actually like named Maureen Dowd, who's very funny, and she said something in the column once that I really thought hit it on the head. It's very simple, the way she put it. But it's like, you know, this crowd, they know what needs to be done probably to really change our image. But their whole thing is, we're number one in the world. We like it that way, and we intend to keep it that way. So, I mean, to really radically change these things where our image would improve, it would mean that we would have to be sort of more even-handed about things. We wouldn't sort of be able to take advantage of this hegemony we want to have in that area of the world. You know, I'm sympathetic to having, you know, stability in the Middle East, both for Israel and all the other and Arab countries and Muslim countries, and also economically. I mean, the whole world industrial system, the economic system of the world, is dependent on oil as a natural resource. It's not just about greedy capitalists or greedy Americans who want to drive their SUVs. I mean, it affects real people, working class people across the world, if you have a major economic crisis. So finding ways that we can make sure that our energy sources are renewable and stable without, you know, looking the other way when Egypt starts, arresting people for speaking out, and Yemen, you know, doesn't allow human rights abuses, you know, they allow human rights abuses to go unnoticed. You know, these are the sort of things that is a dilemma, and I'm not saying that I have all the right answers, and we know they're complex problems, but to not even, at least publicly, allow Americans to sort of wrestle with that stuff and to, as an administration, to wrestle with it, although they may be doing so behind closed doors, and then to turn the other way and just to have this sort of, you know, muscular, arrogant, sort of military-only response where we're going to somehow intimidate terrorists through bombing campaigns is really unsettling and upsetting. Again, with the whole issue in Iraq, I mean, we work closely with Military Family Speak Out, another group that you should get in touch with, and I can help you get in touch with them. These are over 1,000 different families who have loved ones in Iraq who are upset that their loved ones are deployed for a conflict that didn't seem necessary or are now stuck over there being sitting ducks. So this was not about anti-military. The anti-war movement was not about being anti-U.S. military. It was saying, hey, this is about protecting ourselves, too, not only just protecting Iraqis. So, yeah, I mean, they're smart folks in that administration, and the whole idea that, oh, they're not aware of this, I'm sure they're quite aware of their options. So it makes us maybe more critical how we look at the options they do choose to pursue.
And, you know, if you take a look inside the Bush administration, you can sort of see the set of ideologues led by Wolfowitz and the set of oil men led by probably the president himself. Dick Cheney seems to be the perfect amalgam of both, but there's been a lot of talk among the neoconservatives about taking this war to Saudi Arabia, too. That
Yeah.
You know, they almost sound like what you were saying about, hey, man, all these hijackers for Saudi, don't you know? And they want to use that as an excuse to invade it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting that someone, we were talking a couple weeks ago in New York, and we pulled out U.S. troops from Saudi Arabia now that we have, you know, our troops in Iraq. And although there's still military advisors in Saudi Arabia, there's some people are saying, you know, Bush and them may be sort of trying to acquiesce a little bit to bin Laden without making it look like they are, in a sense that they get U.S. troops out of Saudi Arabia, which is one of his major grievances, and they have their new second largest oil supply in the world, their new oil supplier, the new sort of puppet regime they can put in Iraq, and you don't have to make so many sacrifices. I think that, yeah, there is evidence, though, that they think, you know, we need to have democracies in these areas of the world, and the way we know about doing it now, or the way we think that the best way, the best approach, is through the Bush Doctrine, which is a preemptive unilateral war. So yeah, who knows? I wouldn't be surprised to see the neocons push that, because see, from their perspective, they're bringing goodness. They're bringing free markets. They're bringing globalization. And how could it be that the way we live our lives here in this country, how could it be that it's not good for these other countries? So we need to bring it to them. And if we've got uncooperative regimes, then we need to remove them from power. So it's a little self-delusional, and it goes quite well. It complements quite well with what you have with Bush and some of his other people there, like Ashcroft, which is this sort of born again sense that they've been selected by God to bring this sort of goodness to the world. So you've got these neocons who are very idealistic in one way, and then these fundamentalists who sort of feel like, I mean, Bush, there is evidence that Bush really feels that God chose him to sort of lead America through this new time. And that's a little scary, given the similarities that is to Islamic fundamentalism. So.
Wow, yeah, a holy mission from God. It ain't quite the Blues Brothers.
Yeah, well, you know, the more that I think good, if you could say there's a good thing that's coming out of this, a positive development out of all this is that you've got more and more Americans who've been apathetic, politically inactive, getting more active, wanting to get Bush out next year and someone better in there. I mean, a lot of the candidates, you know, are better than him. They're not ideal, but really, almost any of them, except in my opinion, other than Lieberman, is better at this point. It would at least step us a little bit in the right direction. You know, we're not going to have anything perfect next year. So, but I've seen that. I've seen people outside the coast and outside sort of places like Austin, which are great, and Berkeley, but places like rural Texas and Oklahoma, Kansas, Idaho, I've gone and spoken to a lot of groups and seen people really asking questions and being more critical and understanding that we can have a great country and a great traditions here, great ideals, but that doesn't mean that they're just going to automatically be put into practice in this country. You know, that we got to work for them, maintain them, and if you have an administration that's not living up to them, you got to make sure that they are, hold them accountable. So, you know, a democracy is not just something that happens every November, you know. You got to make sure that who's in there is held accountable and are staying consistent with the Constitution. So, you know, we have a big task ahead of us for those people who are concerned about this. Now, there's a lot of other people, I think, not to sound too cynical, who are, you know, comfortable in their lives in America. They're shielded from the problems in this country and the problems in elsewhere in the world, and they'd rather just believe the sort of line that Bush and them give out. And they don't want to question it. They're happy with the way things are, especially if they're in that top percentile of getting nice tax cuts. So that's the problem. But you don't need all those people to come along. You just need that, you know, middle 5 to 7% of people who don't vote or swing voters to go the other way and to get someone better in there. And then we're on our way to a little bit of progress, hopefully. So,
on the religious issue, when you talk about the sort of both sides see God on their side fighting the other and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I noticed when I was reading about you on the internet that you're a graduate of Divinity School, and
yeah.
I wondered, there's a whole section of fundamentalist Christians in America, who, I suppose led by Pat Robertson and the like, who say that the Bible gives all this land to God's chosen people, the Jews, and that therefore it must be the foreign policy of the United States to protect that holy mandate.
And yeah.
I know that's not the way, you know, all Christians in America believe or anything like that, but I wonder if you can address that, the angle that you know, really we're enforcing God's doctrine of who owns what land over there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem. I mean, I think that there's not enough, nearly enough of awareness in this country that our own forms of religious fundamentalism have become problematic for our foreign policy, our democracy, our own freedoms. People sort of, it rubs people the wrong way to talk about that, but, you know, yeah, we have our own problems with fundamentalism just because we don't have fundamentalists here blowing up buses and flying planes into buildings doesn't mean we don't have a problem. As a minister actually in Austin that I've done a lot of work with says, our fundamentalists have power here, so they don't need to, they don't feel that to the extent of committing terrorist acts. So I think that, to the extent that, yes, that this worldview, this very sort of exclusivist, literalist, biblically literalist view of the world and how it informs foreign policy is extremely dangerous. There's not only problems like in places like Texas where you've got textbook problems where, you know, religious right-wingers have taken over school boards and they aren't letting science textbooks, you know, come forward that talk about evolution, things like this. But you also have it on the national level because you've got fundamentalists in Washington, like John Ashcroft and the president and some of other advisors who this worldview is informing the way that they're approaching the rest of the world, specifically Israel. And so you've got a very strange alliance now with Christian fundamentalists in this country and the Israeli right, and it's a very funny, they're very funny bedfellows. You know, you ask Christian fundamentalists, you know, well, what are you going to do once, you know, Jesus comes back to the Holy Land, what you're talking about, what happens to all the Jews? And they'll say, well, you know, they'll either have to convert or they'll probably, they won't be saved either, so that doesn't seem to be a problem, this relationship now. And there are people on the far right in Israel who sort of, that doesn't bother them because they just want support for their policies now. So they can get it from the far religious right in this country. They're happy with that. So this is a problem. So church-state issues, separation between church and state are very important, not only for religious freedoms here, but for how our government, at least for the next year and a half, goes about its policies in the Middle East, because it is tinged with this extremely troubling sort of fundamentalist Christian view of that area of the world. And, you know, it's a big problem. I don't think a lot of people are aware of it.
Okay, well, I know you got to get going. I've got more questions for you, but I know you got to go. So, everybody, this has been an interview with Andrew Rice. He's from the September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. You can look them up at peacefultomorrows.org. And I'd like to thank you for coming on the show, sir.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.